Well, good evening to all. It's good to see everyone out this evening, especially our visitors. We thank you for taking the time out to share some time in worship to our God and fellowshipping in that way. Thank you for taking the time out to do that and showing us and encouraging us and about where your priorities are at. It's always good to see that. I'd like to start off with a hypothetical situation here, hypothetical case. Again, hypothetical, so let's make sure to keep it at that. David Griffin, Mike Hubbard, Jeff Archer. You three are no longer elders here at Jordan Park. Instead, what the congregation is going to do is they are going to vote on a single individual to lead this congregation. And congregation, here are your list of candidates. All the boys from the second and third grade class. Exactly. Sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? It's probably because it is. You think of someone of that age, second and third grade. I went in there and looked, and there were 11 red folders, 11 binders on there, so I'm guessing that's about how many roughly of that age, give or take, that you have in that classroom. But an 8-year-old, guessing that's about the age, an 8-year-old leading a congregation of God's people. It's nothing we would consider even remotely possible, and as you all proved, it is laughable. But guess what? Something somewhat similar to this has actually happened before. In the Old Testament, in 2 Chronicles, we read of a king who took control as king of God's people under God at the age of 8 years old. And his name is Josiah. All right, we're back to reality. Elders, y'all are back in your place now. But Josiah became king when he was only 8 years old. 8 years. Now, anyone who's of the age of 7, 8, 9 years old, or even the ones in the middle school or high school class, would any of you all be ready to actually take on the ruling of a nation? I don't think any of y'all would. Okay, I'm 34 and I don't want that responsibility at all. Not something like that. But this actually happened. Josiah did become king when he was 8 years old. He had a 31-year reign. He did have a father who was evil, who only had a 2-year reign, so he had quite a bit longer in power than what his father did. And generally the lineage, more so in Israel, but even in among the line of the kings of Judah, there was good, but there was also a lot of evil that the kings did as well throughout his lineage. And so I want to look at a few things, make a few observations with Josiah, and then from those observations, I want to see if there's anything that we can apply to ourselves concerning the observations that we make with this 8-year-old King Josiah. But he's not going to stay 8 for very long. And one of the questions that we might ask is, was he really ready to become king? At age 16, Josiah made a very important decision. Let's go to 2 Chronicles, the 34th chapter. 2 Chronicles 34, we might reference the Second Kings account a couple times tonight, but for the most part, we'll be in 2 Chronicles. Let's just back up and start at verse 1, chapter 34. Josiah was 8 years old when he became king. He reigned 31 years in Jerusalem, and he did what was right in the sight of the Lord and walked in the ways of his father David. He did not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. Now, let's fast forward about 8 years. For in the 8th year of his reign, while he was still young, he began to seek the God of his father David. Josiah made a very important decision while he was 16 years old. And that decision affected the decisions that he made for the rest of his life and affected the results of his kingdom through his tenure of 31 years as king of Israel. He made a choice, and that choice was not to serve the gods of the pagans and worship the idols, but to serve the Lord. If we continue on, halfway through verse 3, continue the reading in which he turns from 16 years old to 20 years old. It says, in the 12th year, he began to purge Judah and Jerusalem of the high places, the wooden images, the carved images, and the molded images. They broke down the altars of the Baals in his presence, and the incense altars which were above them he cut down. And the wooden images, the carved images, and the molded images he broke into pieces and made dust out of them and scattered them on the graves of those who had sacrificed to them. He also burned the bones of the priests on their altars and cleansed Judah and Jerusalem. Let's stop right there. Because of his decision to serve the Lord, 4 years after he made that decision, we're told that some results really started coming through. It appears because of his dedication and his zeal to serve the Lord, he starts making some decisions about what to do with the idols that are in the land. And here it describes him going through and cutting them down, burning them, breaking them, putting them into dust. And one of the things that was pretty remarkable to me is in verse 4. Look at this point. They broke down the altars of Baals in his presence. This wasn't some order that he gave for, you know, a certain amount of people to go out and go to this location, and start cutting everything and burning down. He took a personal interest in making certain that these idols were torn down and gotten rid of out of Jerusalem and out of Judea. He took this personal choice to serve the Lord to a really great extent and wanted to be certain that he was doing everything he could to remove the curse from Israel. And you know what? He didn't just stop in Jerusalem and Judea. Look in verse 6, chapter 34. And so he did in the cities of Manasseh, Ephraim, and Simeon, as far as Naphtali, and all around with axes. When he had broken down the altars and the wooden images and had beaten the carved images into powder and cut down all the incense altars throughout all the land of Israel, he returned to Jerusalem. We see in these passages the debased state in which Israel was left in after the reign of Amnon, his father. And we see Josiah making that decision to serve the Lord and to walk in his ways, and we see the results of it. If we were to look in verse 8, this jumps ahead to him being about 26 years old. And if we were to take this 18th year of his reign to be the time frame in which he was doing his first purge, there's a second. But his first purge of Israel between the ages of 20 and 26, you're looking at about 6 years. 5-6 years maybe less, of him dedicating his life to purging the idols and the curse from Israel. At age 26, which is in verse 8, and we're not going to read this, it's a fairly lengthy reading, just going to summarize, but this is the 18th year of his reign. In summation, he wanted to restore the temple for worship. And he gave some instructions on restoring the temple, which had been left to its own state. And so there were a lot of repairs, a lot of restoration and work that needed to be going into the restoration of the temple. He also ordered that the Passover be kept, and that the Passover, which is described as there being no Passover kept in Israel like that since the days of Samuel the prophet. That's in 2 Chronicles 35, verse 18. If you think of the Passover that was kept and the description that was given like it, and no Passover being like that since the days of Samuel the prophet, we're including Saul, David, and Solomon, those kings right there, and all the kings up to the time of Josiah. We're talking about maybe a very grand celebration, or a very strictly regimented celebration, whatever this passage means about there being none like it. There are a few ways that we could take that, but the fact of the matter is that there was something special about this Passover versus the ones that had been in the past, that there was none like it in a very long time, hundreds of years. In addition to that, after the temple restoration and getting the book of the law found, we see that there was also a second purge that began. This is where we reference the 2 Kings account. The 2 Kings account in chapter 23, verses 4 through 20. We're not going to read all of this, but verses 4 through 20 give a pretty detailed account about what Josiah did in the second purge. And just by summation, he defiled the pagan altars. He removed and executed the idol worshiping priests. He burned many of the pagan-related items and did many of the same things that he had done during his first purge of the country. But I think it's pretty incredible that it takes 16 verses, to talk about everything that he did to try to get the curse off the land of Israel. You know, he was dedicated to what he wanted to do, which was the choice that he had made at the very beginning, and that was to serve the Lord. Josiah was also not influenced by the pagan practices that predominated the land early on in his reign. We look at his grandfather, Manasseh. The first 20 years worth of Manasseh's deeds had a residual effect on the country and carried over into Amnon and even into Josiah's reign, in which Josiah did what he could to purge that from Israel. If we were to look at 2 Chronicles, the 33rd chapter, so we're backing up just a little bit. 2 Chronicles, the 33rd chapter, in verse 9, it talks about his grandfather Manasseh and the things that he did to get the spiritual state of Israel into a debased state. It says in verse 9, "So Manasseh seduced Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to do more evil than the nations whom the Lord had destroyed before the children of Israel." We're talking about the ones that inherited the promised land before the Israelites took it over in the book of Joshua. In the book of Joshua, the Lord was getting rid of the inhabitants of that land because of the wickedness that they had. And yet Manasseh did even more so than those nations that were before them. So this was the state in which Manasseh had initially pushed Israel to. Now, I have in parentheses here 20 years. And from the research that I did, what it seems like happened is between 698 and 677 BC was his first 20 years. And taken into captivity, I found a couple of references saying he was taken into captivity about 677 BC, which is also in 2 Chronicles, the 33rd chapter. He was captured by the king of Assyria and taken off to Babylon. And while he was in affliction, he implored the Lord, his God, and humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers and prayed to him. And he received his entreaty and heard his supplication and brought him back to Jerusalem into his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that the Lord was God. And we're going to look at a little bit of this in the next point. But there was some residual effects to the wickedness that Manasseh had done that was throughout the land. And of course, would have been an influence on anybody living in the land of Judah and Jerusalem. But Josiah, again, made that decision to serve the Lord and did not allow these types of influences to influence his life. Also, his father Amnon had a very short reign, just 2 years or less. And in that 2 year reign, he did the same wickedness that his father Manasseh had done early on in his reign. And his reign, of course, as we said, was only a couple of years, and he was killed in his own house. And of course, then we come to Josiah and what he tried to do to reverse that. But because Josiah did not allow these negative influences, these sinful influences, to influence his life, we often wonder, at the age of 8, there had to have been some positive influences in his life. And here are 3 that I think were, to one degree or another, an influence for the good on his life. And you may be looking at this, his grandfather Manasseh, he was one of the more wicked kings to ever live in Israel. Well, that's correct. However, if we were to go back and look, pick up at 2 Chronicles, the 33rd chapter, in verse 13, at the end there, the scripture said, "Then Manasseh knew that the Lord was God." Now, verse 14, "After this, he built the wall outside the city of David on the west side of Gihon, I guess, and in the valley as far as the entrance of the fish gate. And it enclosed Ophel, and it raised it to a very great height. Then he put military captains in all the fortified cities of Judah." Verse 15, "He took away the foreign gods and the idol from the house of the Lord." Okay, so it seems like the influence, at least immediately in the house of the Lord, was gone, or at least the appearance of it was. And all the altars that he had built in the mount of the house of the Lord and in Jerusalem, and he cast them out of the city. He also repaired the altar of the Lord, sacrificed peace offerings and thank offerings on it, and commanded Judah to serve the Lord God of Israel. Now, again, referencing back what I have on the slide here, the last 35 years. His entire reign was 55 years long. We see that in verse 1 of chapter 33. He reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. So, up to about 35 years, we don't quite know. I didn't see how long his captivity was. So, no more than 35 years. It could have been a lot less, depending on the length of his captivity. But it seems like at least Manasseh was trying to do things to undo the wickedness that he had inflicted on Israel in verse 9 of 2 Chronicles 33. So, if we take those last years of his life, we take the reign of Amnon, his father, and the age of Josiah. Josiah is 8 years old when he becomes king. Amnon only reigned for 2 years. So his grandfather would have had to have died when Josiah was about 6 years old. Now, this may just be me, and I've verified with my parents certain memories that I have that have apparently dated as far back as when I was 3 years old. We lived up in Ardmore, Alabama. Our house is actually still there, even though it's been gutted. That was where I first learned to ride a bike without training wheels. Great memory there. Had a lot of good memories in that house. I actually do remember when my grandparents came from Indiana because my parents were going to go to the hospital for the birth of the oldest of my younger siblings. Now, there's 3 years and 10 months in between me and my second sibling. So I'm guessing that to a certain extent you might be able to remember things starting somewhere around 3 years of age. I know I've got a 2-year-old over there, and there is a little toy truck that I got for him a couple to maybe 3 months ago, and it's called a picker or something like that. It's an electric person gets up there in a little box and does the wiring thing. It's a truck that's kind of like that. Well, if you go up there and you show him the toy and you say, "Where did Dad get this?" He'll be able to tell you exactly where I got it from. He's not even 3 years old yet. But, you know, that's just kind of his memory. So if Josiah was about 6 years old when his grandfather died, and he might have started remembering things at age 3, and we know that Manasseh tried to undo the evil that he'd done and recognized and served the Lord, he might have realized 2 things. First off, because of the result of what Amnon, his son, did, realized possibly that Amnon's not going to be king very long, or if he is, he's a lost cause. Amnon was what, 20 at the time, 22 at the time when he became king, and only reigned 2 years? And so Amnon was already to a point where he would have been a lost cause at this point. So when Amnon has a son, do you not think that those of you who are grandfathers in here, would you not want to teach your grandchildren about God? And if you knew that you were the only way that they would actually become a Christian, would you not do that? I'm sure that Manasseh would have done the same. And so Manasseh could have been a good influence in the last years of his life. The prophet Zephaniah. Doing a little bit of research on the prophet Zephaniah here, he prophesied during some of Josiah's reign, and it is also possible that Josiah was a relative of Zephaniah. If you actually turn to Zephaniah, the first chapter, there's a lineage that is there. If I can get to it, started going to Zechariah. Can't do that. Zephaniah chapter 1 says, "The word of the Lord came to Zephaniah, the son of Cushi, the son of Gilead," however you pronounce that, "the son of Armiah," and then that fourth name there, "the son of Hezekiah." So Hezekiah would have been the great-grandfather of Zephaniah, who was Josiah's great-grandfather. Somebody by the same name, Hezekiah. And so it is possible that these two could have been related. Now, if you look throughout some of the prophets, there are lineages that are sometimes given in there. You go to one prophet, and they may just have their father, or it may date back to two or three other generations. And one of the explanations possibly for this is to attribute the prophet to somebody who was possibly known either for their position or may have just been somebody who was well known to begin with. In the land. And for whatever reason, this is a possibility that Zephaniah could have had a positive influence on Josiah, maybe either by relation or even by the prophecy that Zephaniah had around the time of Josiah. We also see Hilkiah the priest. Now, the name Hilkiah literally means Yahweh is my portion. And it wouldn't be beyond the scope to assume that Hilkiah was actually one of the enforcers of the reforms of Josiah on the land whenever he was purging the land and building back up the temple. And perhaps this was an additional figure that persuaded him to follow the Lord. Now, Hilkiah was also the one who found the book of the law while he was carrying out the temple cleansing. And whenever he found the book of the law, he is also the one, whenever Josiah read it, Josiah wanted to know, are these things actually going to happen to us? And of course, Josiah asks and inquires of the Lord and gets his response that in your lifetime, the punishment is not going to be carried out. But when the book of the law is found, we see Josiah implementing the words of the law that he finds and doing even more to try to rid the curse from Israel, and therefore the second purge that he goes through. Now, I've always wondered about this finding of the book of the law. The kings of Judah, some were good, but there were also many who were wicked, and there were many who were wicked, especially leading up to Josiah's reign. And for the first part of Manasseh's reign and all of Amnon's reign, there were two very wicked kings who had ruled back to back. And especially when we looked in verse 9 of chapter 33 of Chronicles about Manasseh seducing Judah to do more than the inhabitants before them, these two Manasseh had been the most wicked king of Israel to preside over Israel, and probably was instrumental in the biggest spiritual decline that Israel was involved in. And if you think about it, in such an environment like that, in such a regime, you might think that, you know, the law of God might have been in danger from somebody who was trying to promote anything that was anti-God and trying to destroy it. So it's possible that this book could have been hidden or filed away and forgotten. And so whenever it was found, obviously it was a very joyful occasion, but it was also an occasion to where the reader, or the listener, in this case Josiah, listened to what being said and said, you know what? We've done a lot, but we still have more that needs to be done. And again, after that, he instituted some of those things that we talked about earlier, such as the Passover and the second purge, to try to rid all of the idols out of the land. Josiah had a lot of events that happened in his life, and we're not going to get to the end, to where he dies. But Josiah's life, starting at a very, very young age, decided he was wanting to serve the Lord and to serve the Lord only. And we see some of the results here of him doing that and how he took the idols that were in the land and destroyed them. We see the influences that he could have felt subject to, but he decided, no, that's not what I want to do. I want to serve the Lord. And he decided to let the good influences in his life teach him about serving God. Now, what are the lessons for us? Well, first off, we can also make that decision to follow Jesus Christ. There have been a lot of discussions and talking stories given, especially this year, about the work at Jordan Park, the things that we are involved in, and trying to spread the gospel. Spreading the gospel to those who haven't heard, and spreading the gospel to those who have heard, but we are still trying to convict and to get them to understand that they need Christ in their lives. I know I talked about this the last time I was up here with the Philippine report, but I couldn't help but thinking of this story about the couple that heard the word of the Lord on the radio and walked all day to find the congregation to meet with, heard the word of the Lord that day, and became Christians, a husband and wife couple. And again, you think about that, walking all day just for that. That's a lot of dedication right there. And that's a great example of someone who is really diligent about wanting to follow Christ. I don't know how long ago this was. It seems like there was an email that was sent to the entire Jordan Park congregation. I believe the context was someone in the that was doing the online Bible program. There was someone else in the Philippines, I believe is where it was, that had been doing the online Bible program and wanted to become a Christian, but didn't know who to contact in that area or really anywhere else to actually come and baptize them. And they got back, a mass email was sent out to Jordan Park, and eventually they found someone to go over there and to baptize that individual. Again, that individual decided right then, as soon as they knew that they needed to be baptized and become a Christian, to do so. There's another story that I heard some 12, 13, 14 years ago about a young man. He was about 15, 16 years of age, still early in high school. And he had a friend of his who was a Christian. The 15, 16-year-old was an atheist, but he had befriended a Christian at school. And this Christian had invited him to come to services, and so he did. And eventually, this atheist decided he didn't want to be an atheist anymore, but believed in God and wanted to become a Christian. Somebody influencing them of their own age in high school. Well, he told his parents of his decision about wanting to become a Christian. His parents, also being atheists, said, "If you become a Christian, we don't want to have anything more to do with you, and we're going to kick you out of the house." Well, guess what? He made the right decision and decided to become a Christian anyway. And true to their word, parents kicked him out of the house. But guess what? One of the elders of that congregation and his wife took him in and continued raising him as, well, at age 15, 16, I'm not sure how much more raising you can do. Basically, they took care of him until he graduated high school, and I don't know what happened to him after that. That was about the details of the story that was given at the time. But if you think about that, in that example, they chose Christ over father and mother, which is exactly what Jesus said you had to do if you were to be his disciple. Another lesson we can learn from the life of Josiah is that we really need to reject worldly influences. And especially if you're not a Christian tonight, reject the worldly influences that are keeping you from becoming a Christian. There's a lot of things in this life that we set priorities on, personal agendas, goals. We kind of want our own independent identity, especially when we're young. We're still trying to figure out what we want to be. We put a lot of importance on social approval and standing. A lot of self-interests come into play. But we also have to think about the influences in relation to our peers, those that we hang out with. 1 Corinthians, the 15th chapter, verse 33, well known to us all, do not be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals. Even with godly parents, it is still tough enough to become a Christian and to live right if you are hanging around the wrong crowd. It's very difficult. And so with that, especially those who are younger, please watch who you're hanging around. If you need to sever some of those relationships because the influence that they have on you is not of a positive nature and one that is going to lead you to Christ, you need to sever that relationship and get rid of it. But to those of us who are Christians, in relation to those who are not, we need to be an encouragement to those who need Christ. Just as those three individuals, Manasseh, for however short of a time it was that he had with his grandson, to Hilkiah the priest, who it appears he might have had many years to influence the king, taking advantage of the opportunity to encourage those who know what they need to do and encourage them to become a Christian. If you haven't taken the Evangelism and Works class, this quarter it's being taught by Billy Brafford. There's a lot of discussion and a lot of talk going on about evangelism in general and narrowing things down very specific. We've talked about evangelism in many different facets, and it's been an excellent class just to look and see all the different types of ways one can evangelize, how we can evangelize on a personal level, how us as a congregation can find additional opportunities to evangelize, and what we are already doing to evangelize, what we can do better, and things along those lines. And you know, when it comes to evangelism, we have a lot of people here that are doing an excellent job in evangelizing to those who need Christ. Last week on Sunday night, who were mainly the people who were up here? It was the young men of the congregation. What were they doing? They were leading singing. What is that? Is that a form of evangelism? Yes, it is. What else were they doing? They were speaking, like I'm doing now. They were praying. They were reading. All different forms of encouragement and evangelism. That's what they were doing. Just a couple of months ago, we had our vacation Bible school. A lot of work went into that, and I saw it. I saw it for myself. And in fact, I'm not going to name names, but I'm going to get somewhat particular here, that I saw on a routine basis several ladies that were in the workroom before services started, and those same ones in there after services started multiple times. You talk about a lot of dedication that was put into it. And that's just one specific example, but there were many of those right around the preparation for our vacation Bible school. Just this evening, there was some song leader training that was going on in the back. Someone there trying to teach and instruct on how to lead singing, how to lead a congregation, and what does that do? That song leading and that encourages a congregation. I love it when we have singings. I like our fourth Sunday nights of the month. I also like it when Jeff does his sermon and song. I enjoy those quite a bit. Singing is something that I've always enjoyed. Therefore, I like The Sound of Music. It is one of my favorite movies. But again, there are many other things that we could look at that have been done in this congregation to encourage those who are not Christians. And I want to talk about something a little bit more specific when it comes to talking to those who are not Christians. I want to talk about peers. Looked at this just a little bit in the last point from a negative standpoint, which was the 1 Corinthians 15 chapter, bad company corrupts good morals. Usually whenever we talk about peers, we usually talk about it in the negative sense. Well, I actually want to turn that over and look at that in the more positive sense. And especially if you are a younger member in this congregation, I especially want you to listen to this. Don't underestimate the influence that you have to your friends and your peers. Don't underestimate it. I go back to that story that I told a little bit earlier about that 15, 16-year-old atheist befriending a Christian that was of the same age. And that individual converted him to Christianity. 15, 16 years of age. That right there is some peer influence for the positive. And it may be tonight that that person is even in the group that you're sitting with. Or it could be that that individual that you need to talk to is sitting right next to you. I would encourage you and I would challenge you as a fellow Christian to use your friendship and your influence to talk to that individual about becoming a Christian. I'll give you one more story along the similar lines. I'm going to leave the name out here because this person might be known to some in the audience. But when I was in the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, I went to Columbia Academy down in Tennessee. And I think it was my 7th grade year, there was a new student that came onto the joined our grade. And and she played soccer, and that was about all I knew about her at the time. Even with my second year with her in the eighth grade, I really didn't know much more about her than that. I think it was somewhere around 15 years later. So I was, what, 12, 13? I was 14 at the time. No. So, yeah, about 15 years later, I saw her again for the first time. Instantly recognized her. Knew exactly who she was. Well, I had told someone that I had seen her, and the person whom I told actually told me the story of what happened to her from the time that I first knew her up until a time that I saw her 15 years later. Unknown to me, while she was still at Columbia Academy, I did not realize that she was not a believer. In fact, she had actually come to that private school, from my understanding, as an atheist, one who did not believe in God at all. But her friends, her peers, talked to her and got her to believe and become a Christian. I didn't know that until 15 years after the fact. But if you think about that, two examples that I've given of teenagers influencing other teenagers. So if you're young, please don't think that you don't have any influence on those who are in your peer group, because you do. Encourage those who need Christ in their life. As we close, we go back to look at Josiah. And there was a question at the end of the first slide about, was Josiah ready to become king? The question is fairly insignificant, especially when looking at the more important question, which is, to someone who is not a Christian, are you ready to become a Christian? The invitation song is number 811, I Am Coming, Lord. By the way, thanks for whoever put this up here. I would have completely forgotten to look at the song if you hadn't done that. But these verses right here seem to me to look from the perspective of one who is not a Christian, but who is answering the call to become a Christian. And I want all of us in here, while we stand and sing the invitation song in a moment, to sing this song in an encouragement for someone in this room who needs to become a child of God. If you are a child of God and you need the prayers of the congregation because you've left your first love, we're here ready to do that. But especially to those who are not Christians, don't miss this opportunity to make your life right with God this evening while we stand and sing the encouraging invitation song.